The entrepreneurial bug does not replace that fire that led me to become a doctor. And so people will oftentimes say, when are you going to quit medicine and become a full-time CEO? Never. I can't replace that feeling that I get of purpose.
What if you could reclaim hours of free time each week, create legacy building wealth, and devote more energy to your passion projects without giving up on your career as a life-saving MD? Dr. Vikram Raya is a functional cardiologist, high-performance coach, and real estate expert, is here to give you the tools, strategies, and solutions you need to transform your life, unlock your limitless potential, and achieve greatness, all while freeing up your precious time. Welcome to Limitless MD. Let's dive in.
All right, guys, let me ask you a question. If you're listening to my podcast for many years now, you know we bring on some of the best guests in the country. Some of these guys are visionaries, they're leaders, they're thought-provoking physicians, and they're here to make a difference. But a lot of times, sometimes you need to uncover the layers of these individuals and really discover who they are. So the question I have for you guys is, what would happen if one of the top anesthesiologists in the country, who's double board certified in pain and general anesthesiology, as well as Harvard trained, realizes that medicine alone isn't enough to serve doctors? What if he thinks he can become the bank for physicians as well? That's when you get someone like my good friend, Zawadeh Marshall. Dr. Zawadeh, welcome to the show, brother.
Vikram, what an intro. Up to all of that, top anesthesiologist in the country, with friends like you, you know, like I feel like I'm 10 feet tall and bulletproof. But thanks for the warm introduction. I'm thrilled to be here. The journey has been an exciting one, fraught with ups and downs, more ups than downs. But I think your audience can likely relate to a lot of what I'd love to share and the experiences that I've had. But certainly this platform, your group, the Limitless MD community, and the Viking Capital group, I think are kindred spirits of mine. And I love spending the time with you all in person at the conferences, but also certainly in this format.
So, you know, I think you've been on our podcast before, but I have some new information that I want to share with the audience out there. So it's really about the why, right? We're going to build this intriguing narrative of a physician who's not satisfied with the status quo. So, Zawadeh, if I met you 10 years ago, who were you and what were you chasing?
Sure. So 10 years ago, I was 30. I was still in residency at Harvard. And I was still pretty pie in the sky about making an impact in helping others and being fulfilled with the challenge of learning how to be a good diagnostician, being a good clinician, managing up, right? Like when you're in residency, you all remember you're pleasing your superiors. And so if you're the intern, you want to make sure your resident is happy and the chief resident is happy and the attending is happy. And so we learn quite early how to develop the emotional intelligence to be performative while learning and demonstrating that you know the thing they want you to know while you're also trying to just survive the work hours and all of those things. And so I had no idea then that I would be, that I could or would have had the opportunities or the doors open to expand the horizon for what I've a career, fulfilling career, by not only owning my own practice, thriving during COVID, at a time when things were really scary for business owners and for the population at large, and also running a lending company that's growing quite quickly with the challenges that come with scale as well. And so I don't know if Zawadeh at 30 would have predicted Zawadeh at 40 and what's happening now. And I think that's the part of being an entrepreneur that's exciting. I think that folks that can really we'll know that it's those surprises that make it all worthwhile.
So I get the fact that, you know, these things sort of unfolded and that was not your original intention, but you were chasing something back then. What was that?
Yeah.
Was it a vision?
Yeah.
Was it a goal? Was it a number? What were you chasing?
Yeah. So it wasn't a number. I think I'll tell you that a part of what's been motivating for me and for many of us, it's you got to get back to the origin story of how we ended up to where we are. I am in large part shaped by my upbringing as the eldest child to my mom and dad. My dad had I have an older step sibling, but in our family unit, I was the eldest, and they got divorced when I was pretty young. And it was always ingrained in me as a child in a third world nation, a developing country, Guyana, where I'm from in South America, a poor country, but we were a middle class household. My dad is an architect, was an architect. He passed away earlier this year. My mom was an entrepreneur herself. And so we had all the trappings of a middle class family in an underdeveloped nation. But it was clear from a very early age that I was going to be their retirement investment plan, right? There was no 401k that they were going to be tapping into. It was going to be me. And so they poured a lot of stuff into me in terms of resources, educational, energy, and in developing me into someone who could aspire to do more than they had done as my parents. So we moved here when I was 17 years old. And I remember there were some kind of pivotal challenges in my formative years. For instance, I had a very pronounced stutter as a child. Mm-hmm. I just had output failure. My brain, I think, would move too quickly, and my mouth and tongue couldn't keep pace with getting the information out. And I think that singular kind of defect in my brain and mouth shaped my personality at that age, because mm-hmm. it made me in the classroom, in the playground, someone who was quiet, not because I wanted to be, but I was rehearsing the lines of what I wanted to say and practicing it in my head before I would say it. Yeah, so I had to rehearse my lines. And what it meant is that in the classroom setting, I'd be the last person to speak. So I became very astute at listening first, at internalizing information. By the time I was ready to say what I wanted to say, I'd already gotten a lot of inputs from what everyone else had said. And so it made my commentary appear more reflective than my peers, because I was taking so much time to do that. And, you know, there's something that happens when you lose the confidence of being able to express yourself and having to kind of grow into shaping how you present vocally, that was pivotal for me as a professional, because now I think folks will often say, like, you know, like, you seem so comfortable speaking in public. Because I've been on the stage since I was 7 or 8 years old, rehearsing what I wanted to say, and it's been incredibly helpful. But so you go from that to moving from the South America to the United States at a time when it was college, and changing my social dynamic, having free and reduced school lunches when I was a freshman, and having to ensure that my peers in the classroom, I didn't stand with them in the lunch line, because I didn't want them to see that I was getting the free lunch ticket, and getting to a place of succeeding in the classroom enough to get offered scholarships to go to Emory and then to Harvard, and knowing now when I see patients in my exam room, there's so many of them that I can relate to because of where I've come from. When I see an angry, upset person who seems to be a little miserable, and borderline rude, I can see my aunt in them. When she's in pain and she's hurting, she's crotchety, right? And so my instinct is not to become defensive or to dismiss them, but it's more or not to have some empathy for what they're going through.
No, I was like, I just wanted to double click on what you're saying. You were able to go from your childhood to schooling to the medical school to residency, and now you're practicing and you're taking care of patients now with all this, and you're able to have the deep insights and wisdom. You're speaking to them. You also had a personal breaking point when financially, as you're trying to grow your practices, and let's talk about how that maybe shaped how Doc is origin.
Yeah. So I learned when I was going from medical school to residency, it was the first time I encountered the financial system outside of a student loan, right? And how the markets viewed me as a doctor. And I needed to borrow the money to transition. and had suboptimal FICO profile, as many doctors do, a ton of student loan debt, like many doctors do, and income at that time in my life that was minimum wage almost. And so the banks wouldn't lend at that stage. And that was the first time that it felt unfair to me that I had this promising career ahead. The only debt I had was debt that I had to get because I couldn't afford medical education cash. And then I encountered it again when I started when I was in practice as an employee, as an associate, and being promoted to become a partner and needing to borrow the money to buy into that partnership.
That's right. That's right.
And because of the way anti-kickback and Medicare rules work, the bankers have a hard time collateralizing a partner buy-in loan. And so you have to kind of piece the money together and get personal lines of credit at much higher rates than you should be able to get the loan for, because you're now a partner in a large healthcare facility. And then you fast forward again 3 years after that, I'm starting my first practice and needing to do the build out of a surgery center, the acquisition of medical equipment, needing for merchant services. And I list all these things because many of you in the audience would have encountered the financial markets at multiple different checkpoints. And the way you're treated is very variable at each checkpoint, but it's not the same way that accountants are treated. It's not the same way that your MBA peers are treated, because they oftentimes don't have that debt burden that we have. And that period of mortgaging your youth, where we're in the library and the classroom in our mid, late 20s, early 30s, when everyone else is making money. So at the age of 36, you'll have a FICO score that's a 650, when the average American FICO score is a 725 at that age, right? And so we appear to be ugly ducklings on paper just by virtue of the fact that medical education costs a lot. And it's a time in our lives when we're having to access capital to live, to build, to invest in our future and our careers.
You know, me and you come across a lot of physicians, and the concept, it seems to be the theme I get, is so many doctors feel broke even when they earn multiple six figures. And part of it is this ability not to be able to gain loans or intelligent debt to expand their practice. But it's more than that. It's a psychology as well. Part of your profession is to understand a physician and get them the capital they need to move forward. But help me understand this concept of physicians don't feel wealthy.
It's a complicated psyche, Vic. And if we had a psychologist here, it probably serve us both well. But I'll tell you that there are a couple of different things that we experience as doctors going through the journey. There's a huge imposter syndrome as we deal with climbing the ladder of academic kind of hierarchy and feeling like the next room we're in, someone is smarter than we are. And then also feeling like the world owes us something because we've been sacrificing so much personally over the course of our time in training that when we finally arrive, or we try to arrive before we should. So is there's an absence of financial literacy that makes us want to acquire stuff before we can afford to acquire it. So there's going to be student loan debt. There's some consumption spending that we do as well, where we're taking vacations and buying bigger cars and homes that then we can afford at the time we do it, in the hope that our future self can pay it off. And then your future self arrives and you're making the money, but that money is all accounted for in things you've done in the past. And so there's a compounding factor of good investment debt, the debt that you'll borrow for education, to buy your home, to do the things that you need to do. But we, as a cohort, tend to do a lot of consumption spending that we don't see happening with nurses and anesthetists and attorneys as much as we do. And it's tied to the fact that we don't have the financial literacy, but we also feel as though we've been sacrificing so much for so long that we need to have something to show for all the work that we've done and the investment we've made in our time into this career, that we acquire things oftentimes just to feel like it was worth it.
So the delayed gratification tsunami results in the doctor car, the doctor house, and the doctor schools, you know, private schools we send the kids to, right? So, and that financial literacy, it's not there yet.
And listen, I speak as someone who is at the helm of a lending company, who takes good pride in my FICO profile, but I'm guilty of it as well. Like I need to have the trophy to remind myself that all the work was worth it. And the trophy can be whatever it is that you care about, but I do take stock in having some visible physical reminder that the sacrifices that I make, I can see it, I can feel it, I can experience something for it. And that manifests itself in healthy ways and unhealthy ways in each of us that we need to reconcile with the who we are and the why we do what we do.
So now I want to put on a different hat. I want to put on this entrepreneur hat that some physicians and more are starting to put on over the last 2 decades. More and more physicians are realizing, hey, there's a different way to play the game. And that's perhaps scaling their clinics, perhaps that's investing in real estate or stocks or starting companies like you did. So let's talk about starting a fintech company while practicing medicine. You know, what were the early days like? Did you have doubts? Were you scared? And how did you know it was going to work out?
It's a lot in there. The doubts were there and they're always there. And it takes turning that anxiety and the fear of failure into an insatiable curiosity and work ethic to overcome the things that you worried can catapult the company. I think in the earliest days, it felt to me like being in the exam room, in the operating room, in the clinic room was just not enough for me to feel fulfilled, because I was increasingly frustrated by note-taking and the clinical obligations outside of patient care that comes now part and parcel with medicine. I was being frustrated by having to work harder to make less with declining insurance reimbursement. And there's this groundswell of us that feel as though the marketplace, the way insurance works, the way the health system is designed, it's really a sick system, and there's not enough that we are able to do and control in how our work day goes and how we're able to impact the lives of our patients, that it leads to a frustration with how we viewed ourselves as doctors when we decided to enter the field. And that's, I think, a big reason for burnouts within our communities. And then we're also people that are curious. We're scientists. So we see the world through a lens of exploration, of diagnosing issues and problems and trying to find a way to solve it. And so we'll have ideas outside of medicine that we'll find the itch and we'll want to pursue them. I think the challenge for me now, though, having done both and I'm actively doing both, is the entrepreneurial bug does not replace that fire that led me to become a doctor. And so people will oftentimes say, when are you going to quit medicine and become a full-time CEO? Never. The satisfaction that I get from putting a needle in someone's spine and having that sciatica go away and seeing them 3 weeks later when they come with cookies to my office and they're crying out of appreciation because they feel better, I can't replace that feeling that I get of purpose with loans that I issue to borrowers. But what I don't get in the exam room is the ability to lend $150 million worth of loans to folks that were just like me, that when you say your loan is approved, you hear them cry on the phone because they've been denied 3 or 4 times before because they're doing family planning and need to get pay for fertility treatments, or they need to get out of that suffocating credit card debt at 33.5% interest. And I've given them a lifeline to now revamp their credit profile to access capital more cheaply in the future. And this can be done at scale. Now, to the question of how do you do it? How do you think about it as an early stage company? For me, the key was having a really awesome partner, another physician with a business mind who thought like me, but was very different from me. And we saw each other's blind spots. And in early days of any company, there's a huge part is capital raising and being a part of disparate networks where we can tap into raising money from groups that didn't overlap too much was a powerful tool that we had at our disposal. But Kenton is a very methodical strategic mind. And for me now, he is the number one source of guidance. Because if I call him with an issue that we're having, a challenge that we're having, granular or big picture, he has the ability to see my blind spots. So having a person, it could be a partner, it could be a mentor, it could be a coach, it could be the role that you play for many of your mentees and the folks in the program, that person can always help you to take a step back and see the forest for the trees. The other thing is, that's been very intimidating, is raising money from your network. And I've said this before, but it's a humbling and challenging thing to do. When people know you as a doctor and you're telling them, hey, I've got this patent that I want to apply for because I've got an idea. I've got this lending company that I want to buy into this apartment building. I think we can do it together, guys. If we'll raise the $9 million, if you give me, you know, $500,000 and you give me $50K, we'll get there. That process is extraordinarily humbling and anxiety inducing, especially when you know that the investors that are writing your checks don't really understand how that apartment building is going to get to 99% occupancy, how the marketplace for rental units work over there. They're trusting you to do the work. They're trusting that as you put together the business plan, the pro forma, that you've done all of the inputs required to mitigate their risk. And that's an awesome and intimidating responsibility. That means that at times you're wearing two hats. One is the innovator for the company that you want to see the company grow and thrive. But the other is a hat that could be in conflict with the company where you're wearing the investor hat too. Yes. So you're representing the investors in a way that others that don't have investors who are their peers and mentors and friends and family can just be solely focused on what's best for the business, not what's best for the investor. But when you're having to marry those two things together and split the baby and ensure that you're articulating things in a way that's clear to folks who are not sophisticated enough to understand all the underpinnings of the business, but you also got to be true to the business to ensure that you can deliver upon what the business needs, it requires a different set of skills. And a part of how you split and bridge that gap is having a talented team of leaders around you who are really good at what they do. As good as you are in cardiology or dermatology or plastics, whatever it is that you do, you want to have the CFO who's really good at numbers, yes, at pro formas, at projections. You want to have your head of marketing who understands the way Google Analytics works, who knows what a digital campaign is compared to the TAM and all these industry terms. Have the people around you who are the best at what they do to support your efforts, and so they can own the domain and you can lead with inspiration, with empathy, with kind of a ruthless determination towards getting to the goal. That's your job in the seat as CEO or founder, and have them help to pull oars with you because they're adding a level of expertise that we don't have. I think many of us attempt to become experts in accounting, in marketing, and you want to do everything. And I think that could be a fool's errand because, and it's maybe a little bit of hubris as well, in that you need to ensure that you've got the outsourced help that's expert at whatever it is that they do to get you from point A to point B.
You know, the question I ask a lot of founders is really, you know, what are the blind spots? What are the things you wish you knew? Someone told me, I want to just highlight some of the things that you shared. And this is critical knowledge for anyone out there who's about to start a company, already is in a company and wants to scale it. It was really, you know, the mission, the vision, which Zawadeh elegantly shared. But then it was also a partner who's has some overlap and some similar attributes to you. But obviously, there's a complementary skill set. And so, you know, 1 + 1 = 4, you know, kind of thing. And that's awesome that you found that person. And then he talked about the number one superpower of an entrepreneur or a CEO is raising capital. It's not easy, right? And it's not asking for money. It's offering opportunities. But you have to fully believe in the opportunity. You have to have, you don't need sales skill sets or tactics. It's conviction. And when you hear it from, you know, our friend here, Dr. Marshall, he speaks with conviction and passion. He's felt the pain of the avatar he's serving. And so it's able for him to transfer that certainty. It's all about certainty. And that's how he's able to raise $150 million or provide $150 million worth of loans and things like that. So, and there's always going to be risk, but as a physician and as an entrepreneur, two things hold true. It's our goal is to mitigate risk and achieve an optimal outcome. And you're able to marry the two. And I love that. So I also want to talk about how, even though you're known as the doc-to-doc guy, you've also built a powerhouse of a practice in Atlanta. You have three locations for regenerative spine and pain. And you have, I think, how many ASCs now at this point?
It's two ASCs.
Two ASCs. So tell me about the thought process from being a team member, an employee of a practice to, hey, I'm going to hang my own shingle up. That must have been a daring and bold moment. And then two, how do you get the wherewithal to scale this thing, you know, with all your other commitments?
Sure. I think many of us, and I say this the royal we that I keep referring to, is that I know your community and I know the people that are attracted to consume this kind of content. And we've got a lot of things that are similar. But I was feeling the feeling as an employee that I was providing more value to the organization than was reflected in my compensation. And it's not just compensation in dollars, but compensation in time, like how much time I had off, control of my schedule, the ability to be able to be the master of my fate. I was outsourcing all of this value to an organization that paid me well, but it was not even, it was maybe a quarter of the value that I was actually creating. And so I had the itch. I knew inside of me from the beginning of that job that I was likely going to start my own, but I wasn't sure that I knew what it took to run a company, to grow and scale a company. And so I felt like that first job was them paying me to learn from them on the mechanics of interventional pain management. So I had a front row seat for all the intricacies of pre-certifications, personal injury business, marketing and referral channels, developing a brand and having patients and referral partners refer to that brand. And so by the time I was leaving, I'd proven to myself more than anything else that I can generate real economies, real revenue, not just from my direct contribution in the procedures I did, but in the labs that were ordered, the imaging that was ordered because of me, the physical therapy, and all these other ancillary systems that I wanted to vertically integrate and capture that revenue and capture that value within a practice. What was helpful is that I didn't burn the bridge when I was leaving my employer. I think oftentimes, many of us feel this level of there's this chagrin. There's just like you begin to resent the employer for the position that you're in, and you're thinking about all the money that they're making off of you. And by the time you give notice, you kind of feel like, I want to tell the man, get out, I'm out, you know, and drop the mic and leave. And in my case, I knew that Q4 was my most valuable time to them. So they couldn't lose my income in the fourth quarter of any year. If I gave them notice in the first quarter, they'll have time to replace me and get someone else in, and they'll kind of mitigate their losses. So I timed when I was going to give notice to be the fourth quarter, when I knew that they needed me the most, and said, look, I'll stay on and work part-time for you guys 2 to 3 days a week if you continue to pay me 80% of my salary. So I literally like chipped the negotiation to where I was giving them 30 to 40% of my time and retaining 80% of my income. And they couldn't say no at that point. And it felt to them like I was doing them a favor, right? Yeah. I'm not going to abandon you guys. Yeah. And it allowed me to begin to put the groundwork in for my own business while having minimal income disruption. One of the main things I see today as a lender are folks that quit and then apply for loans to fund their new venture. And they've got no income to show for it. It's hard to secure financing for that new business, for that new practice, if you've already left the thing that gave you money before. And now you're asking a lender to underwrite a loan based upon projections only, as opposed to, in my case, it was projections plus multi six-figure income that I was still getting from my own employer. And so by the time I consummated the loan, and then I left, they already funded the loan, my money's secure, I can leave, you know, 5 months after I gave notice, which is what I eventually did. So think about...
Say that again, because this is very key. A lot of doctors, even people who we work with in Limitless, I mean, they're ready to, they have that itch, they're ready to move, they're ready to be bold and start a venture, but, and sometimes they leave their practice and they do a 1099. It's not like they lose their income, but they move to something, at least on paper, that looks very secure, a W-2, onto 1099 or locums or telemedicine. But the challenge is, if an underwriter looks at that, their loan capabilities probably are less than before. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely it is. And I think we all understand why this happens. You know, like you're ready to go. You've got, you feel inspired. You're sick and tired of being sick and tired wherever you're being employed. And you want to leave as soon as you can and start the thing going. But to the point that you're making here, Vic, a 1099 is not as stable of an income as a W-2 employee to a lender. Because we can track and we can see exactly how much money you're getting on a payroll paycheck after taxes. The biggest challenge in 1099 is the reason why we all love 1099 work, is that we get to write off our travel, our car notes, all of these things. And so you end up declaring very little income in net income that helped you to save money on your taxes. Well, now you don't have income to show a lender that you've made this money, you can repay a loan. So it becomes this, you've got two competing goals here. You do the locums work or the contractor work to keep income there, but to mitigate your tax liability. But at the same time, you're diminishing what you can show to a lender is your real income to fund to get a loan approved. So it's a typical challenge that folks have. And my recommendation, you don't have to do it the way I did it, but you want to preserve your stable income for as long as possible while you simultaneously begin to apply for the loans, you pay for your consultants, you get your contractors in place, and you leave after you've got your financing secured to then begin to launch. And then you can still do your locums work and supplant your income with some other contractor revenue streams.
Yeah. You know, it's like people always complain about the W-2, and I'm probably part of the situation where I'm like, yeah, be K-1, you know, and do all that because I want people to be entrepreneurs. But you need to learn to weaponize your W-2 before you are ready for that transition. Think about it. A physician who's earning six figures is one of the safest things a bank can lend to. So you want that. You want to gather the loans. You want to harvest that before you move on to your next venture. So that's awesome advice. So as we start wrapping up here, I want to ask you a couple of questions more on mindset and identity. What belief did you have to unlearn to succeed in business? And I think this is probably going to be a very powerful answer for a lot of the physicians and entrepreneurs and doctors who are listening. What did you have to unlearn, buddy?
We all subscribe to some mental model over the course of our lives. You got a belief system of what's up and what's down and what works. And I've always believed that working harder and dedicating more time, doing the grind, investing more kind of sweat equity into whatever it is, yields the better outcome. And in the seat that I'm in now, the more I grind, the more I sweat, the more I toil, the more blurred the vision becomes. And I realize that my greatest strength to my organizations is the ability to be clear-minded and clairvoyant by being in a position where I'm allowed to see everything. Mm. And if I'm too granular and focused on solving a problem myself, I can lose fact of what's the actual vision and mission here. What is the goal of this challenge? And if I solve this, if this domino falls, what is the next thing that needs to be done to get me to where I'm trying to be? And so a part of what I'm trying to say here is it's the do-it-yourself mentality. Physicians, we work in team-based environments a lot, but in all those teams, we're intended to be the leader of the team. And we have a strong self-reliance on our own abilities and our own capabilities. And being able to surround yourself with the right people, but recognizing in those people when they have hit the ceiling on what they can provide for you at that time of company building. And so a large part of what's challenging for me today is people management, inspiring, motivating, knowing the incentives that'll keep a star, a 10Xer, has a lot of different needs from you as their leader than a 6Xer. And you need both in any organization. And so being really attentive to investing the time rather than in the toil, but in nurturing the people and ensuring that that you're giving them what they need to succeed, whether it's coaching, whether it's motivation and compensation, whether it's a path to promotion, and having that, and ensuring that you don't put new people in the way of other folks who view themselves as being able to ascend into that role. And it's a complicated thing to look at an org chart, look at your goals, and marry the two to figure out who do I need to get from here to where I need to be. And it won't be the same people that you need to get from where you are to the next step up.
That's awesome. That's very powerful advice, guys. I think it's stop being the doer and start being the thinker and the architect, right? And you really are the architect of this greatness of the of both companies that you've created. And so there's a book recommendation that we have to drop in here, guys. I'm sure you've already read it, Zawade, but it's Who Not How by Benjamin Hardy. Phenomenal book. And it's really, you know, talking about, you know, if you can find the right who's, you can accomplish your goals. And then the other thing is constantly up-leveling your team, right? As the company is going to keep evolving, normally the team members evolve with the company, but at some point they hit their own plateaus. And then you have a choice to make. Can you help keep them growing? If not, maybe it's time for them to exit and you bring on new team members. And there's like almost an iteration or evolution every time, every 2 or 3 years in their companies. And at some point, you start hitting these all-stars who have insatiable appetites similar to you, and they grow with you. And then that's when you get the tenureship. And so we have guys who've been with us for 5 years and 3 years and 4 years. So then they're like, okay, we found our core team, right? And that leadership team can take you to the moon. And then at some point, you have to ask a tough question. At some point, Zawade, does Zawade have the capabilities to go from, let's call it, I don't know, $5 million company to a $50 million company? If he does, great. If not, other options are maybe he can become a chairman where his vision, his mission, his relationships, his connections, and his tenacity is still the DNA of the company, but perhaps an executive can perhaps run it and do more of the day-to-day, but he's more of that big picture visionary. And so these are all the options that, you know, unfold over time.
Your summary was better than I said it, and I couldn't agree with you more. And I think the last thing I'll add to all of that, as you're trying to think through how to coach, to lead, to be clairvoyant, and all the things that you mentioned, I know you stress this a lot. It's personal health and wellness, right? To be able, you know, like monitoring your sleep, knowing when you thrive, when you're most creative. Are you a morning person or a nighttime person? And enabling your lifestyle to support the things that'll get you at your best. Ensuring that you're healthy from a working out, a relaxation, having a time with your family members, the things that recharge and give you energy. Because when you're running a practice and leading a company, it's extraordinarily discharging. And you've got to know how to find that recharge so you can show up the next day, the next week, the next month, the next year, energized and motivated to actually do the job.
And that was powerful. And I want to leave with one thing. I'm going to double click on sort of something you said, which is really, you know, obviously the vitality, the health, the mindset, everything is integrated, but all of this comes to this concept. And that's the name of my show is really Limitless, right? So what does limitless mean to you, Zawade? And what's the impact you want to have on the world?
I've recognized relatively recently that I've spent my entire life pleasing others. I was looking to impress and please my parents. I was looking to impress and prove to my mentors and the folks that told me that I was going to do well, that I can do well. I am a father. I'm a spouse. I have employees that rely upon me to feed their families. I've got investors that rely upon me to give them a return on their investment. And limitless for me now means that I will be able to deliver upon what makes Zawade happy and feed my soul with the outputs of energy that that helped me feel purpose-driven and having made an impact in the lives of others. I think that I'm extraordinarily gratified at my clinical practice and the impact that we have with patients. And the communities of folks like, I mean this genuinely, Vic, being a part of the Limitless MD community and being able to share my story and hear the stories of others and get the questions from the community and get the pearls of advice and get the investment. Like, your community has been an ardent supporter of the DoxyDoc mission and vision in giving their capital and then using our product as well. We're doing a raise right now in Start Engine, and you guys have showed up to support us in that endeavor. And so now for me, it's about being free to practice at the top of my skills and know that I'm serving myself while I'm helping others at the same time is limitless in Zawadeh's mindset.
I love it. And how can people first learn about DoxyDoc and then also get into your ecosystem and universe? How can they be part of it? And then please share them if there's a way for them to be part of. I think now it's a very approachable investment to potentially be part of DoxyDoc as an investor as well. So you can be a recipient of a DoxyDoc loan, as I've helped a lot of my physician colleagues and friends and clients utilize that for real estate, for their practice expansion, for trips, travel, for reconsolidating debt, for intelligent investments in certain things, gap funding. It's been very useful and it's invaluable as well. And then on top of that, obviously the investing, hey, you invest in real estate, great. You invest in stocks, great. You invest in crypto, fantastic. How about investing in a physician-led fintech company that can is probably going to revolutionize the world? That's an opportunity that Zawadeh has created. So with all that, what's give them some links, give them some strategies to get connected to you.
Sure. We're doc2doclending.com. That's doc2doc.com. And we've got /limitless. And that is a co-branded link that allows anyone listening here to have access to the special features that we have for this community in specific. We do a concierge application process. We give some cash back on borrowers from here that come into our ecosystem as well. But we're raising the funds in Start Engine and startengine.com/doc2doc. And there you'll see the investment. We have some bonus shares available for certain investment tiers, but the minimum is $500. The highest we've received so far is $150,000 from a single investor. And we're capping this raise on July 22nd. We're targeting $2 million and we're at about $1.37 million right now. We encourage you to reach out. I will leave some after links as a follow-up to this podcast, Vic, where folks can kind of see investment prospectus as well.
Yeah, they'll all be in the show notes, my friends, when this podcast gets published. So we're looking forward to it. Thanks, Zawadeh. I know you're a busy man. You have a lot of things on your plate, but I really appreciate you stopping by and sharing your wisdom and us having a deep conversation about things that matter, especially for the community that we're serving here. So listeners, thank you for supporting the podcast. Really appreciate you guys. Thanks for subscribing and downloading the Limitless MD podcast. I look forward to bringing you a lot more cool episodes. And until next time, be phenomenal.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Limitless MD. If you found value from this episode, I encourage you to share this episode with a friend and let me know by leaving a review. For more information, make sure you check out the links in the show notes below or simply visit VikramRaya.com. Until next time, be phenomenal.